All right, we're going to go ahead and get started with the next session here. Nonverbal communication. Or as I like to say, what you're saying when you're not saying anything. A nonverbal communication is an essential element of communication. It's that part of speaking that doesn't reflect itself in the verbal of what we're actually saying. I want to go into some of the importance of it over the next hour and discuss kind of why it's important. And there's no way in this talk that we'll develop all of what nonverbal communication is. People get degrees in this stuff. When trying to understand this and how it plays into persuasion, how you can put together or actually plan the elements of nonverbal communication that help you put together a more effective presentation. But I want to start with some of the cues of nonverbal communication. First with the definition. When we talk about nonverbal communication, what are we referring to? Nonverbal communication to me is what separates the written word, what's on a piece of paper, from what's presented. So if I were to give you all a copy of my speech, you could look at it and draw something from it. But it would be a different experience entirely to hear the speaker deliver that presentation. Those differences are made up with the hand gestures, the tonality, the rate of delivery, the eyebrows and nose and cheek movements, the movement back and forth, all of that, the nonverbal communication element. So I want to go over five cues then for kind of what nonverbal communication is, kind of what you're looking for. The repetition, contradiction, substitution, complementing, and accenting. Repetition serves to repeat the message that a person is making verbally. So if I make a statement, my nonverbal communication can serve to augment that by simply repeating it. Right? So I can make a statement and do a gesture that supports that statement. I can say my first point is, my second point is, and my hands are repeating what I'm saying. You follow me on that? It's just simply repeating what's already happening in the words. It's not really adding anything in addition to it. It's just making the message more clear, more perspicuous. The second element that nonverbal communication can have is it can contradict. I can say, the moon is made of green cheese, while shaking my head no, telling you that, no, what I'm saying really isn't true. I can make a statement and contradict it with my nonverbal communication. It can also substitute. You can substitute for verbal language. For instance, if I'm taking a position, making a statement, I can sometimes say the same thing without using words. For instance, if you raise your hand and I'm calling on you, I can nod to you, right? Or raise my eyebrows toward you to acknowledge your presence. It doesn't necessarily mean that I'm not saying anything, I'm not communicating a message, it's simply substituting for what might otherwise be said. Complimenting is adding to or complimenting the verbal message. If you're talking to someone who just had a major loss, someone lost their dog, their cat, you put your arm around them, right? That's complimenting your sympathetic message through a nonverbal message. And accenting would be to underlie the verbal message. So if I pound the table when I'm very passionate about something, it underlies that verbal message. Ah, there it is. The University of Chicago study tried to look at the spontaneous, ephemeral, made-up-on-the-fly gestures we do on the everyday basis. So they took a look at people and tried to evaluate their communication. They just filmed people communicating. And they tried to look at their spontaneous gestures. And they concluded that at least half of all language is imagery. So in other words, if we were to eliminate imagery in our communication, my to you like this, you would half the words. It would eliminating words in communication. It'd be a lot harder to understand what you're saying, right, if you eliminate half the words. That's what it's like when you cut out the nonverbal elements of communication. So that's what the vital element of nonverbal communication, but it also has some confidence elements. There's an element of how you communicate when you use gestures effectively. An article from the Science Daily, this was a couple years ago, reported on a study from the University of Alberta, and I'll just read you a couple paragraphs from the study. Dr. Alina Nikolaitis and her research colleagues observed the hand gestures of bilingual children as they told the same story twice, first in one language, then in the other. The children used gestures. So we're looking at children, they're bilingual, meaning they speak two languages, and they're telling the same story two times. And we're filming the story, and these communication researchers are evaluating how they communicated by looking at the film, right? The children use gestures a lot more when telling the story in what they considered to be their stronger language. In other words, if the kids were speaking in a language that they were more comfortable, they used gestures more. Initially, we thought the gestures were related to meaning, that they meant something on their own, but now we believe they're more related to language. When the kids were comfortable with what they were saying, they used gestures. When the kids were in a language that they weren't as comfortable in, they were less gesticular. Isn't that interesting? And what that tells us is that there's an element of communication related to that language, related to sending a message, that the kids were comfortable using in their home language. And when they were less confident, I'm sure they didn't. They were fluent in that language. They were bilingual, but they communicated that lack of confidence just through their gestures. That's really interesting. And so it's a subtle message. Your judge isn't going to say few gestures lacked confidence, right? They won't look at your presentation that way, but they may, on a subconscious level, notice your nonverbal communication and evaluate it differently just based on that, knowing that gestures lead to more confidence. If someone is standing in the room stiffly, and we could also take a key from that as well. Obviously, none of us are going to speak from the no hand gesture spot the whole time. This is actually a little bit uncomfortable. I speak with my hands, so this is a little bit uncomfortable to do. But you will see speakers who clutch the podium. Have you seen that? The white-fisted clutch? I think the human face is really expressive. My younger brother, I call him my expatriate younger brother because he's living in Vancouver studying film now. He's a computer graphics guy. So you know when you watch a movie and you see the big explosion? That's what he's doing, the computer graphics stuff. And one of the things he did when he first got into art is he purchased a book of reference guide for facial expressions. So it goes through and it gives you a image and a facial expression and a word. So anger and stress and concern and then happiness and levity. And it just goes through every little adjective and a word to describe it and someone showing the face. You turn the page and there's another person doing the same thing over and over again. So graphics design artists, people who, cartoons and stuff like that, use those. And it's so funny to think about all the different ways we communicate with our face, all the different messages we send. And all of that's without saying a word. You know, when we smile, it communicates a multitude of messages. When we're smiling while talking about our day last week, we're expressing the fact that we enjoyed that day, that we were comfortable with it. But if we smile while talking about a carnage, several hundred people dying, it's a whole different message entirely. Right? And so the combination, right? Or you thought that was something that had to happen, or maybe you are a psycho. So it's a combination of the verbal and the nonverbal that comes together to send that message. You can't isolate one of those. It's also interesting to note that the facial expressions for happiness and sadness, anger, surprise, fear, and disgust are the same across cultures. So if you take that book of expressions and you send it to someone across the world, they would be able to use those same reference models to communicate. In fact, Pixar animation movies, the Disney movies that like Up and WALL-E, those movies do better overseas than they do in the United States. Whereas some of the more movies that are based on real life characters don't do as well. And a lot of that's just the fact that the human expressions and interactions are known across cultures. There's a human being element there. We're the same people, and it connects that way. So facial expressions are an important part of this. I think the biggest thing I want you to get out of these modes is that I want you to be cognizant of them and to be thinking about the way you communicate with those. I think too often speakers look at speaking as a unidimensional activity where we're speaking and that's it. But we're communicating in all these different ways and it can work. Even if you're thinking in a speech, I don't necessarily need to say that. Or I can communicate this without words and finding a different way of doing that. How about body movements and posture? Think about the way people hold themselves and the message that sends when you hold yourself in a particular way. Now, you've heard when you were little, I'm sure, that you need to stand straight. Now, the question is why? What message are you sending when you fail, when you slump your shoulders, when you sit with a slouch?
You're totally relaxed.
You're completely relaxed is what Jimmy says. Do you guys agree? My point with the posture is that you communicate respect when you hold yourself back. And that's, I think, what parents suggested. When we're communicating with an audience, we need to maintain that same respectful posture. Whenever you're speaking, you need to maintain that posture that your parents are telling you to have when you're little. Yeah, I mean, be thinking about your posture and the way you're holding yourself when you enter the room. You'll see people before their speech while the judges are preparing, kind of sitting in the corner or whatever. No, you want to be in front of the judge as if you're speaking the whole time. That's your attitude. Your posture needs to be maintained. So you don't want to turn off these modes. I don't have to do that right now. I'll worry about that later. It really needs to be something you're thinking about and concerned with. Gestures are another element that's really woven into the fabric of our everyday lives. You think we point, we beckon, do a lot with our hands to communicate. When I was 12 years old, I took my first sign language class, and there's a whole element of communicating through just your hands that you're missing. I think the key with gestures is that they're overdone often. People work too hard on coaching the gesture where another nonverbal mode is more effective at communicating that. I know for me that often gestures become forced if I practice them too much. And the lesson I hold with gestures for you guys is that they need to be natural. When you're thinking about employing a gesture in a speech, make sure you stand in front of a mirror or do it in front of an audience first, especially if it's a new gesture, something you've never tried before. When we're thinking about talking with our hands, I think we become self-conscious about that. It's something we're worried about. I know even now as I'm talking about gestures, I'm very mindful of every hand motion that I make, right? Because it's something that you're all looking at. I know you're judging my gestures. I know what's happening. And so you need to be aware of that gestures are an important part of how you speak and that it's possible to overdo them. At the same time, you don't want to go no gestures. And there's a healthy balance within that. Look at how you communicate in an audience. Look at how people on television communicate if they're at a table in a conversation. Look at how your parents communicate with each other. And just turn off the sound. Just imagine there's no sound on that. And just look at the gestures and the hand motions. And you'll see that there's a lot of interaction that happens just that way. And gestures need to be a natural part of how you communicate, but that does not necessarily mean that you aren't more expressive in front of a room. You wouldn't use more gestures when speaking to an audience. Everyone stand up. Box one gestures are right in front of you. They're movements from the wrist. One arm, hand gesture, that would all be box one. And that's kind of right in front of our body from the wrist. It's a comfortable gesture for a lot of starting speakers. It's not an endearing gesture. It doesn't dominate the room. It's not captivating. And it's right in front of you. It's a small gesture. Box two is when we incorporate the elbows and into that area just immediately beyond it from the elbows. That gesture, again, is a little bit broader but fails to really capture the of having the room. Let's move from the shoulders for a box three gesture. This is the Roman orator. I'm coming to speak. I'm in the forum. The international peace sign is like this. This is a very welcoming, open gesture. Box four is when you move your feet. So you when you're moving your feet in an oratory, you want to make sure those arms are out. You want to make sure you're moving with those arms to maintain openness with your audience. So we're not closing ourselves off when we move our feet. Right? This is movement from one point to another when we move like that. When we move like this, it's with purpose and direction. Isn't that interesting? So when we move in our box four, we keep the gesture out and move. What's the most important of the boxes? Which gesture do we really need to have down? One from the wrist, two from the elbows, three from the shoulders, four was the movement. The answer is variance is key. You need to do all the gestures in a good speech. You can't have one, it gets old, it gets distracting, it gets repetitive. And it's almost to the point where if you go a minute and 30 seconds without changing boxes, you're doing something wrong. So a minute and 30 seconds is time to change that box to really send that message. That's the key with the gestures is variance. Same with your rate of delivery, same with your tone. You want to be careful with your gestures to avoid misinterpretation. I remember when I learned the gesture for integrate, then I overused it, and that didn't work out so well. And then I was using it when I didn't mean integrate, and then it got out of hand. So you really need to keep track of what you're saying and what the message of your gesture is. One of the really good tools I've had is recording myself. So I get a camera out, set it up, I talk, and then I take a look at those gestures and see how they come across. I'm my own worst critic, right? We're so critical of ourselves, we hate to look at ourselves on tape or listen to ourselves. That's very the key there is, again, going to be the variance and filming yourself or working with a coach who's going to recognize the repetition within the gesture is very effective. So let's jump into the next one on eye contact. The eyes are the window to the soul. Have we heard that expression? And eye contact tells your audience that you're on the same wavelength with them, that you're able to communicate with them. There's an idea of dominance in eye contact, that when you communicate and the person you're looking at looks away, it's the alpha male effect. Eye contact is important because it connects with your audience. It shows that you are speaking directly to that person. So the danger is that you don't want to be speaking above your audience. You don't want to, talking like this, nobody really wants to hear what you have to say. But it's hard to look away when someone's speaking directly to you and has a message for you. Spread that eye contact around would be the most important factor with eye contact to make sure that you give eye contact to everyone in the room. But the second factor is with people in a larger audience, so in a larger room, make eye contact more with the people in the front of the room. There's a trick with large audiences and large rooms that to the people in the back, because of the sunken nature of our eyes and our skulls, it actually looks, they can't tell who we're making eye contact with. And there's a V effect with who they think we're making eye contact with. So if you look at the person near the front, the V goes into the back from that point. Kind of a nice trick when speaking, as you will, in front of larger audiences later this year. You ever been uncomfortable by the space given you by someone in conversation? There's an element of space in how much proximity we have with our audience. And the key there is, it really does depend on your room, how much space you want to provide. I generally coach that depending on the room, you want to begin 8 to 10 feet away from your judge. But you want to finish 2 to 3 feet closer to close that gap and create more of intimacy with your audience. So, and we're all going to have broom closet rounds. I mean, everything gets smaller. Your voice gets smaller. Your gestures get smaller. Your steps get smaller. Even your words get smaller. It's just so much more intimate. Everything is in a smaller place. So what you want to do is make sure that you maintain a respectful distance with your audience. When it's really, really bad, you may make a comment about it when you enter the room. Like if it's really, really awful, so you can sort of apologize for that space. Or even in the middle of your speech, if it's something that's unbearable and you need to take a step back, you need to be mindful of it, because you don't want to maintain, once you realize that things are awkward and uncomfortable and that it's just too steamy for having just met, you do want to take a step back like that. But it can send a message of aggression and intimacy. It can be closeness or pressure on your audience too. So it's a whole variety of messages that space sends. Now if it's nonverbal, why did I put voice? Yeah, the tone, the rate of delivery. What's the ideal words per minute? There is no ideal words per minute for platform speaking. The key is variance. The key is if you go a minute and 30 seconds at the same rate of delivery, you need to change that. When my first year in speech, I found my comfort zone where I could really speak. It worked in debate, it worked in platform speeches, it worked in impromptu to an extent. I was set. And I had few verbal pauses, I got through my material, I was good to go. And, 13 years old, you got it all figured out. And it was wonderful. You get going, and you're good to go, all the way till the time's called. The problem was judges didn't catch anything. what you're saying completely washed over your audience. It was like listening to classical music. What was that note 3 notes ago? It was so smooth, you couldn't even hear it, right? So you want to make sure that you split up your delivery. That happens through a number of factors. The first is the pause. I say that a pause is like a postage stamp. Whatever you say immediately afterward is mailed directly to your audience. A pause or a white space, or have you guys ever seen recording equipment and the up and down mark of a measure of sound? It gives a flat line. So whatever you say next really impacts that space. And the same thing works for us. So if there's a big pause, it really impacts your message. A pause also demonstrates confidence. I think at an animal level, we're worried that people in the audience will run up, beat us over the head with a club, and take over the speaking podium from us. But if you pause and show you're relaxed, right, and that you're confident, you're not afraid of someone taking your podium away, you can keep going. In fact, I can pause 5 seconds if I wanted to. I could take a drink of water. No one's going to interrupt me. Right? That's the message you send when you pause. I'm so not worried about someone coming up and taking over my podium. You could have run up, but I knew you wouldn't because I was that confident that I had control over the situation. See that? That's the nonverbal message of a pause. So we've looked at rate, the pause, and your tonality is important too. You got to speak with the voice you're given. You can't really change that. But you do want to vary that voice. So there are times when you want to speak more softly, more quietly. And there are times when you want to speak more loudly. And a lot of that's driven by speech content. If you want to incorporate speed in your speech, some of you guys like to speak really quickly because speaking really quickly allows you to get through more material. And some of you are able to articulate well, unlike me. And you're able to get through that material easily, right? If you want to incorporate speed, the place to do that is in the middle of the speech. Starting and ending quickly is not good because it portrays a lack of confidence. So if you need to have some speed, maybe you have a technical point or something where you really have a lot of material you want to get through, put that in the middle. The beginning and the end are for slow times.
What about pitch?
So pitch like high up like this or low? Yeah. Is that what you mean?
Would that be part of nonverbal communication?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a part of nonverbal communication. It's again going to be motivated by content. A lower speaker has more credibility. And a higher speaker demonstrates, a higher pitch, excuse me, demonstrates more enthusiasm and energy, but can lose the credibility. The message there is you got to speak with the voice you're given, and I find it very difficult to coach kids on pitch. It's hard to really think about it and get your mind around changing the pitch. Probably, and there are moments I think I'm more on the interp side where it's significant because you're getting into a character and trying to portray something, and the pitch can be very effective there. The idea of intensity. Again, a lot of this stuff is going to be what you personally add to it. You can't take the message of this talk and incorporate it in a presentation without making it your own first. But intensity is going to be a reflection of the amount of energy you project. And that energy could be a loud energy or a soft energy. It could be I am projecting energy! Or it could be, I am projecting energy. And both of which are an intense, powerful form of communication, but they send different messages. Both of which can, there's just different places for them. With intensity, I encourage you to experiment when you're practicing. You've got a line in your piece, and you just try different ways of delivering it. Try shouting it. Try whispering it. Try running through it. Try going very slowly. Try pausing right before it and right afterward. See how it works. Experimentation like that with intensity can be very effective. Timing and space are an element that's motivated primarily for most speakers by the content. Your pacing is determined by what you have to say next. But some passages of literature or written text are presented more quickly than others, just by nature. For instance, I'm sure there are people in this room who can read through literature faster than I can, and others who are going to be more slow at it. So there's that natural rate that we have. If you have the same pace throughout the entire 10 minutes, your audience will not catch what you're saying. You need to be pausing over those points that you want the audience to remember, over those key lines, and slowing down at the beginning and the end, at any point in the speech that you really want the audience to remember. Pausing more between your sentences and words and making more of an impact. Pauses are very good for emphasis. In fact, pausing for emphasis is more important than telling your judge, pay attention now, this is really important. What I got to say next is really important. The best thing you can do to emphasize a point is pause. That is the most effective way of emphasizing in speech. It's even better than getting loud. As guys, don't we think that like if we get loud, that'll be what we really get the message across? That's what I thought when I was growing up. Is that an issue for parents? Say I'm not a parent. I don't.
Got it.
I think there's an element in communication, though, that's what makes the pause so powerful, is that that's the gut reaction. That's what we're expected to do when we really think something's important. And the pause is just, it brings it out. My twin brother Travis used to use a pause really effectively sometimes when he was doing persuasive speaking. There's something about, I think people in persuasive speaking are most emphatic about getting that time in, getting every argument down. And there's something about being able to say, I'm so confident in this material that I can pause and really take this material slowly, and you will still come to my conclusion. I don't need to speak for all 10 minutes. It's almost like this message sells itself. It's very effective. All right, nonverbal communication needs to be a subtle element. There's an element of communication, there's an element of hand motions and gestures that almost become mockery of the gesture itself when you overdo something, overacting. And you want to avoid that, make it your own through a subtle, and the best way I think of doing that is through feedback from family, friends, coaches, and through video camera work with your own criticism. Very important to make sure it's subtle. You also want to make sure that you're avoiding the bluff. And I call a bluff kind of from the idea of poker, where you're putting too many chips in the pot for what your hand can handle. You don't want to deliberately alter your body language to do more than your body language can provide for your speaking. But it's an important element. It's half of the message of your communication. It conveys confidence. There's significant elements there. But you can't cover a lie with body language. You can't change your own interaction. And I think if we look back at those modes, contact, facial expression, tone of voice, posture, gesture, intensity, timing and space sounds, These are things we do every day when we're interacting, right? We don't pick, today I'm going to be better at eye contact. See, I'm going to try tonality in my voice. It's something that happens naturally. And I think that's the most important element here, is that you be aware of it, that you understand that these are elements of your communication that you need to understand, but that you don't push them so much that you try to overcome. I want to give you a few things to focus on for each one of these elements so you can sit down for yourself and sort of do an evaluation of how you're communicating nonverbally. So for eye contact, are you making a connection with your audience? Is it the right person you're looking at? Are you looking in the audience at the person that you need to look at, or are you looking at... And for facial expressions, what is your face showing? What message are you sending with your facial expression? Sometimes when my facial expression is inappropriate for the moment, my mother would tell me when I was little to run to the restroom so I could look at it in the mirror and get an idea of the facial expression. So, yeah, of course, it would change in the time to get there, but to get an idea of whether the facial expression was situation appropriate. Are you mask-like and unexpressive? Or are you really animated with your face? These are things that you can find for yourself through film or by asking others. You got to mix it up. There are moments where you're presenting material. You're presenting a research study, talking about the methodology of a study. And when you're doing that, it's probably not appropriate to talk about the 150 people who were surveyed in order to come to this conclusion. The margin of error is plus or minus 3%. You know, that sort of thing. It's not. But when you're talking about the number of people who died in Sudan last year because the African Union hasn't been intervening correctly in the genocide there, That's where you don't want to deadpan. You want to make it content appropriate to what you're saying. What do you see when you look in the faces of others? And when other people are communicating, what messages are they sending? And is there a way you can copy that when you're delivering? For tone of voice, are you projecting warmth and confidence? Or is your tone of voice really strained or blocked? What message are you sending with your tone of voice? You could even take these questions and run through a video clip of yourself. Kind of go through and do an evaluation. What do you hear when you listen to other people? What is the message that their tone of voice tells you? What can you extrapolate from that? Under posture and gesture, does your body look still and immobile, or is it relaxed? Is your positioning stiff, or is it comfortable? It's impressive the way tension can be found just through the shoulders and what's communicated. I'll have a student who's very stressed before a round. It'll express itself just there, very tensed. And that can be a easy indicator there, that nonverbal message. What about the person you're speaking to? You can often find a degree of tension or relaxation in that person. Acceptance of a message is often signaled by that relaxation. If they're not buying what you're saying, of course, they'll be closed body language, but more tense in the shoulders as well. They're looking for a respectful posture, as a de facto, like a default posture. It's an overall message you're sending, right? So these elements, when you perfect them, 90% of people will never notice the difference explicitly. But there will be a subtle change in your delivery. They'll say you look more confident. They'll say you look more credible, that you look like you know your stuff. Well, you might not know your stuff any better, but your shoulders were held the right way. Does that make sense? So it's not as if that one element derails the entire presentation. But together, when we become aware of the way these things impact our speaking, it kind of helps you develop that. That's when your presentation comes to the new level. You want to maintain a respectful position and a comfortable rate of delivery to begin. So the tone of voice should be regular, the rate of delivery should be confident and calm, conversational. It shouldn't be anything out of the ordinary. All right, let's go through the finish up on this list here. Let's go to intensity then. Are you communicating in a flat, cool, disinterested way, or are you over the top and melodramatic? Where is your speaking in that range? And it's really good when you're practicing to practice over the top and melodramatic and then to practice deadpan so you can feel what that difference is like. Many of you feel like you're too over the top and dramatic because internally that's what it feels like. But you can almost always go further, especially in practice, just to understand what your range of delivery really is. And you'll find that when you actually get into competition, there's a moderating effect of having an audience. You don't feel like stepping out quite as much. So in practice, you were all out there. The box three gestures were perfect. And you were really going into it. But then in competition, it's more muted. Have you experienced that, competitors? More muted actually in competition. So it's okay to practice big because it's going to get smaller when you actually compete. For timing and pacing, do you think the audience caught your most important point? Was there a flow to your information? And did your pace match the flow? When I was 12 years old, my mother got an art teacher who specialized in like art appreciation, that sort of stuff, who gave us a lecture on nonverbal communication and really turned me around. I was sitting and she started... I'm 12 years old. I know the world, right? I'm on top of everything. She's like, I'm like, come on, really? It's just completely incredulous. And she's like, Cody, of course, doesn't believe any of this. And she picked up on all these nonverbal clues. And I was just shocked at all she was able to figure out based on just the way I was interacting. Her name is Nancy Coco. She went on, her husband was in the military. She moved to Colorado, worked with Andrew Robler. Then moved down to Texas and worked with the Nasser family. So, like, national champions sort of followed her wherever she went. But she really turned me on to what this is and gave me a couple books to read and then kind of did it on my own. What I did, though, is I worked in individual segments. So I said, I'm going to work on eye contact this week. And it wasn't necessarily when I was speaking in practice, but it was just everyday communication. I wanted to make sure that my eye contact was good for a week, and I focused on that. And then my gestures. I wanted to make sure that my gestures matched what I said, and I focused on that. Are there any questions, then, about nonverbal communication? Yeah.
Practice. You haven't talked much about nonverbal habits.
See it on film is probably the best way that I found to get that done. One of the things that I found was helpful was just asking people after a speech. So anytime you guys give a presentation in front of an audience, find people in the audience that watched you and get their criticism. Now, people you don't know. So there's the mom in the back of the room who's watching her kid. She just stays for your speech. You know, go talk to her. Say, hey, I really want to learn, what did I do that was distracting? What did I do that was repetitive? What did I do that worked? Don't argue with her either. Don't be like, really? Because I thought that was great. You know, you don't know what you're talking about. Get out of here. Be receptive to that feedback and try to learn from it. You just have to, and some of that's, dude, you're touching your tie way too much.
Yeah.
Or this motion is becoming way too repetitive. That sort of stuff. For you, though, as you're competing, if you're doing something for more than a minute and a half, it's got to change. That helps get rid of some of those repetitive things. If you've got the same tone of voice for a minute and a half, time to go to a different tone of voice, different rate of delivery. If that hand motion is still there, a minute and a half later, all right then, set small goals for your success to try and evaluate your presentation. Film yourself, take a look at that film, and break it down based on these categories, and come back in 5 minutes for more on audience appeal.